RadioInfluence.com.
This is Landry Football on Radio Influence, the only podcast where you can get perspective of what happened on the gridiron through the eyes of a coach, scout, and front office administrator. Now, it's time to step into the film room. Here's Chris Landry.
Hello, everybody. Happy Thanksgiving as we come to you for this Tuesday, November 26th on the Landry Football Podcast. We are, reminder that we are doing this show, the only show this week. We typically do that. And the reason is we assume you're going to be feasting and spending time with your family or traveling. Be safe out there if you do. And I'll be working, but because of the compressed week with basically Thursday and Friday being like a Saturday and Sunday, and then you got the Saturday and Sunday of football, my work and the previews and everything on LandryFootball.com and all my consulting work, it's kind of compressed to where we were just going to get into kind of some discussions and kind of look ahead to this big weekend and talk a little bit about a few things. So we're going to be back with you next Tuesday. So be safe out there in your travels and have a blessed Thanksgiving. Want to thank the folks at Radio Influence for bringing you this podcast every Tuesday and Thursday, Tuesday this week. So want to get into a few things. We're going to talk a little bit about some things to understand in coaching searches to kind of put in perspective of what's going on and why it's going on. Talk a little bit about ownerships in the NFL. We're going to talk a little bit about Thanksgiving Day traditions, and we're going to got to talk a little bit about Lamar Jackson and what he is being able to do and what does it mean for the sport of football, the NFL, and where it's going and the changes with that. We're going to get into a couple of questions that we have as well that you've sent in. So we've got a few things we want to get to today as we head into a big football weekend. So as we head into this Thanksgiving weekend, it's always kind of a benchmark time in football for me. Because first of all, in college, it's basically the last week before conference championship game. So it's the last weekend. It's rivalry games. It's going to get in the modern era. It kind of gets the last standings before the last standings. For the NFL, it becomes become nut cutting time. It's the games after December. After Thanksgiving, we always say the games after Thanksgiving are most important. Now, in order for those games to be really meaningful, you got to be in a position going into Thanksgiving. So, look, it's the stretch run of the season. It's the very end of the season for college football. You know my feeling. It's basically 2 weeks of college football left, and then it's over. And then we start it up again for the playoffs, and we have bowl games before that. But it's a weird calendar in college. NFL, certainly we're getting into pivotal games, and it's why, you know, the NFL kind of takes center stage. College football loses it to the NFL. I always have said that using the bowl games in December to give another metric to evaluate these teams is the way to go. It would make December for college football, which March is for college basketball, and it would be a continuum. It would make the season go from last week of the season to conference championship games to meaningful bowl games, and you work your way with the, you know, G5 teams and the Power 5 teams, and you work your way through and you work your way all the way up to January 1st, and then you pick bowl games, the two or four teams for the playoffs on January 2nd after the bowl games. I think that's the way to go. I also think college football would be better off schedule-wise to put a couple of games on during the day. They've lost Thanksgiving Day to the NFL. The Lions have always been on. The Cowboys are on, and then there's now a night game. Well, they put a game up against the night game, Ole Miss-Mississippi State. But, you know, I've always felt like a if you can revive Texas, Texas A&M, put it on Thanksgiving Day. Put that in the middle of the day up against an NFL game. Take a one of the rivalry games. Heck, Virginia Tech, Virginia. You don't want to move Ohio State, Michigan. I know that's going to want to be your centerpiece. But take a game like, you know, if you're Georgia, Georgia Tech. If you want to be, if you're a Big Ten team and you're playing Friday night games, you play, why not put a, you know, the Axe game, Wisconsin, Minnesota, that might be really good. Now, put that on Thanksgiving Day. I think it would be really, really beneficial to do that. Oklahoma, Nebraska doesn't play anymore, but the Thanksgiving Day game on the 1971 was incredible. It was still, you know, certainly one of the greatest games I ever saw in the 35-31 game, and that was on Thanksgiving Day. I think you could do some things there. I would like to see, with all the games going on the weekend, and Friday's a bigger football day than Thursday. I just think taking a couple of games that maybe you could really make the rivalry a little bit better, put some of those games that are maybe sneaky good and put it on Thursday. Heck, if you wanted to give more of a high profile to the Civil War, Oregon State, Oregon, or the Apple Cup, Washington State, Washington, or, you know, if you're, you know, really hard to the day after Thanksgiving has become a little bit of a tradition for some teams. But, you know, I think even going back to some of the older games, the Penn State Pitt back then, and schedules are difficult today. I get it. But playing a game like that on Thanksgiving Day would be really intriguing, and I'd like to see them put two more games on Thanksgiving. An early game going up against the NFL game, late afternoon game going up against, and then the night game. So I think there should be three college games in addition to the NFL. I think that college football loses a little bit of the season once it winds down to the NFL. In terms of, I want to get into a couple of things in terms of coaching searches and talk a little bit about what's going on and with the Cowboys and how it relates to some ownership issues, and a couple of other things, get to some questions. But, you know, one of the things about the tradition of the NFL on Thanksgiving that's interesting is I get asked this every year, and I tell this story. I said it on another forum, but I wanted to mention it here, that the Lions tradition on Thanksgiving goes back a long time. And people ask me, my God, why do we have to endure the Lions every year? And I get it. There was a petition within the ownership. It was Carl Peterson that actually brought it up at one owners meeting that we need to rotate the games. And, you know, we ought to have the games on Thanksgiving. And you know, we ought to all have our chance to do that and get the – well, there's a reason for it. Guys like Carl, kind of some other people in modern day management and ownership, kind of look at it from a selfish point of view. The reason why the Lions got the game was back when Bert Bell was commissioner. He came up with the idea of playing an NFL game on Thanksgiving, pro football on Thanksgiving. That was considered heresy. No one's going to come to the game. And this was pre-television, too. So no one's going to come to the game. My God, we're going to take a bath and tickets. And back then, you didn't have season tickets and luxury suites. You know, it was a different world back then. So, no, I want to do it. This is going to be good for us. There was some gravitation towards playing Thanksgiving Day games in college back then. That started to come a little bit later, but they had a sprinkling of a few. It was really something that was more of a high school tradition. If you go back into Thanksgiving Day games, the old Turkey Bowl, you know, tradition games, that was kind of a more of a high school thing. But it kind of gravitated to college, and Bart Bell wanted to do it in the NFL. No one wanted to do it. No owner wanted to do it at all. And they thought it was, you know, I don't want to be the guinea pig. It's just a disaster. Well, Mr. Ford, Mr. William Clay Ford Sr., said, look, if you want to do it, we'll do it. We'll do it in Detroit. And that's what you want to do. It's good for the league. You think it's worth doing it, we'll do it. So there, off they go. Well, it had better success early on. Not great success, but some success early on. They stuck with it, and they stayed with it. And you know, it had more success. Well, once it had success, the Cowboys came in and said, well, we want to do it. Let's have one in the late afternoon. So, again, the Cowboys did not want to do it in the beginning, nor did anyone else. But, you know, always looking out for themselves, they wanted to do that, whereas Mr. Ford was kind of looking out for the league. So as we've gone forward to where it's still a tradition, still a Detroit tradition, it's something that they hold near and dear. And quite frankly, they haven't had anything to celebrate in Detroit in terms of football on the pro level. Other than, hey, they got the game on Thanksgiving. And it's a positive when they're even not eliminated from the playoffs by Thanksgiving for them. And certainly not a good game this year with Chicago Detroit. But keep in mind, as you're watching the game, and it's likely to be a dud, and neither team are going anywhere, it's a game that's in Detroit out of loyalty to the Ford family and what they did. And so when there is a petition to spread it around and move the game around, the league said, no, but here's what we're going to do. We're going to start a night game tradition in the NFL Thanksgiving night. And they've done that. And they put some really good games at night, and it's usually a potentially, you know, good game. Because here's the thing. Dallas has been mediocre at times, and sometimes they play a bad team, and those games are not really good. And Detroit's usually not good. So, you know, oftentimes you get one of those games where maybe even two that are not very good. Now, in this year's game, Buffalo is a playoff team. Dallas is trying to fight for, you know, to stay right neck and neck in a division with Philadelphia where nobody's good enough to win it, it would seem, and the controversy with Jerry Jones, more on that in a minute. But keep that in mind. That's the reason why they haven't done it. So, listen, I applaud them for being loyal to the Ford family and the Lions family for doing it. But college football, get your act in gear. Get some of those games on Thanksgiving. Heck, if you want to do it, and even an Iowa, Nebraska, some of the games that you would normally see on Friday or on Saturday, let's get three college games. Listen, I think Ole Miss and Mississippi State has created an identity for the Egg Bowl that if it was on Saturday, nobody knows, nobody cares, it's lost because those teams are not real good. Ole Miss, Mississippi State becomes featured a little bit on Thanksgiving night. Look, go ahead if you're Virginia Tech, Virginia. If you're Iowa, Nebraska, Wisconsin, Minnesota, an Oregon State, Oregon, Arizona, Arizona State, Oklahoma, Oklahoma State, whatever the case may be. Clemson, South Carolina, Texas, Texas A&M, again, if they can get that back. Georgia, Georgia Tech, Louisville, Kentucky, Indiana, Purdue. If you're one of those teams, why would you not want to put it on Thanksgiving? You could showcase that, look, it's a rivalry game. And you learn a little bit about some of the things. So the fans can learn a little bit more. You'd be surprised how it would create an identity for your program, build it up even more. I don't know that you take a lot of big-time games and put it there, but I think you could take Ole Miss, Mississippi State tag games and have a noon game and a 11 a.m. game, a 3 o'clock game, and a 6:30 game. That would be a great college football triple header, and you can watch that. You can watch the NFL. You can watch them both, as I do, but you have options. So anyway, I don't know why that was in my mind. It was. So there I said it. Want to talk, as we've got some coaching search stuff that is going on, and we're going to have more. want to remind folks that it's the time of year. There's a lot of speculation, and I'm not going to tell you to watch what you believe and all that kind of stuff. Understand that the complexities of discussing jobs becomes about in a search gathering information and concepts. So there's a lot of people that are talking, and there are a lot of people whose names will come out that not so much as candidates, but we talk to them about the job, and then maybe one or both sides will let the speculation kind of grow to maybe see which way the wind takes it. But there's really not a strong candidacy of a guy in a job, but he may talk to him to shed some advice. Being involved in that process, I've always recommended, hey, you should contact this guy or that guy. You should talk to him. He had a job that was very similar to the one that you have. And talk about what he did and how he did it. You can unearth a lot of information that you can really use when you're interviewing the candidates that you're legitimately considering for the job. Here's the other thing to keep in mind. Not all conversations go all that well. I am going to, you know, get into, for example, in the Florida State job, it was Mark Stoops recently talked to them. Well, sometimes the interview or the conversations, official interviews or not, sometimes there's a debate on whether it was or wasn't. It doesn't go well. Usually, if it doesn't go well for one side, it doesn't go well for the other. So then it becomes, well, I'm not going out with you. Well, I didn't want to go out with you anyway. And it becomes a he said, she said, in this case, he said, whatever the case may be. And in that, there's just not the connection. There's just maybe a level of interest, but there's concern about the program. Like Mark Stoops had been at Florida State as an assistant, had a lot of concerns about the programs, how it's been run, what's the administrative setup's going to be going forward. And, you know, he was there. He saw it where it was a program in his mind that Jimbo Fisher decided to say, thanks, but no thanks. I'm moving on from here. Well, he wants to know what's going to be different. Well, that may not be taken very well by the people interviewing in the process. So then you end up with, well, I talked to him, but I have no interest in leaving where I'm at XYZ school. Well, we called and told him he was not a candidate. Okay, fine. First of all, understand this. No job is ever offered to anybody unless they're going to take it. Okay, it's rare that you get offered the job and then somebody turns it down. And the reason is because you already know through conversation whether somebody's going to take it or not. In fact, you may even ask, if we offer you the job, would you take it? Yeah. Because at that point, you'd want to, you know, you wouldn't say, well, I have to think about it. You'd say, well, yeah, I mean, you know, I'd want to maybe 24, 48 hours to make sure that everybody in my family is comfortable, but you know, at that point, you'd want to get to the point, are there any issues that we haven't addressed that would be a concern and a deterrent from you taking the job? So you already pretty much know whether somebody's going to take the job or not. So you don't offer it to them if they're not interested or if it doesn't feel like it's a fit either way. It's kind of like popping the question to a lady. I know there are some people that ask the question and they get turned down. If you ask that question and you get turned down, you probably didn't have a good assessment of where your relationship was. Because you don't ask the question unless they're going to say yes. Everybody laughs, oh, she said yes. Well, they usually do. Because you wouldn't ask if they're not going to say yes. It's obviously pretty devastating in a sense. So I equate it to that. So everyone likes to say, well, we turned this guy down. He was never offered the job. No, Florida never, quote unquote, offered the job to Chip Kelly because he wasn't interested. Scott Frost was more interested in Nebraska. So they got Dan Mullen. Florida got turned down by both. Well, no, they didn't offer the job to either one, but that was the pecking order of what they decided. Now, not everybody was in agreement in that, but Dan Mullen was, I don't know if the third choice is accurate, was certainly on that top tier list and certainly the best fit for the job, then certainly doing a better job than Scott is doing at Nebraska and Chip's doing at UCLA, different situations. But don't be fooled by the whole, well, we never offered, jobs never offered to somebody, but you know somebody's going to take it. But there's an interest level or not, and those things kind of work its way out behind the scenes. So understand that everyone is prideful. Nobody turned down my job. Nobody ever would turn down my school. We got this and that. Things are not what they seem to be on the outside as they are on the inside. And yeah, you're a booster and your dad's a booster and your third generation booster doesn't mean squat in terms of you knowing. You know what somebody tells you second or third hand. But inside, it looks a lot different. So keep that in mind that the whole, this is who they answered, who they're talking with. It's like a duck on water. Looks pretty calm, but under the surface, there's a lot of paddling and a lot of stuff going on. I also wanted to, before I answer some questions and we call it a week, and address a couple of other things. Ownerships in the NFL. I've been critical on other forums about Jerry Jones and how he's handled running the Cowboys, and mainly due to his ownership style. Look, you own a team, you can do whatever you want. The reasons why you win, the reasons why you don't win. And it's an attitude, it's a culture. People on the outside don't think there's any harm with an owner speak. In fact, the media loves it. Love getting quotes from an owner. Many owners don't even talk to the media. Don't even give them the time of day. So they love it when they do. So owners get hailed in a positive sense for doing it. But it comes at a cost. And it comes to the detriment of your operation. An NFL organization has to have one voice. Has to be the head coach. The general manager needs to be behind the scenes. He may have power over the head coach on certain issues and may even be the guy that hires the coach. But if you let anybody other than your head coach talk about your team will not respect the head coach. They may not show disrespect in words, but they don't respect the head coach. They just don't. Been around this 30 years, and I can immediately tell when there's a level of respect and accountability that players feel towards a head coach. And if an owner like Jerry Jones, he's going to do his little press conferences in the locker room after every game because his ego wants to see himself on TV, you could just see that he's got PR people taping it so he can go back and watch himself. Or having these press conferences. No GM or owner does that. But Jerry does. Because it's about Jerry. It's about look at me. It's not what's best for the Dallas Cowboys. It's what's best for Jerry. People say, oh, look at that roster's good. Jerry doesn't make decisions on that roster. That's gone to Steven, who oversees it administratively. And under him, the draft is organized and run by Will McCray. They've done a nice job. There's a collection of talent on the team that's pretty good. It's not a great team. They don't have great culture. They're not very organized. They're not very well coached. But the culture there is the head coach. Is the owner. Established by the owner. And so by hiring a head coach that's an easygoing guy, that's going to put up with the shenanigans of an owner being the front guy is why you're limited in who you're going to hire there. Until the owner says, I'm going to step aside publicly and let the guy be the voice, which he did. He did it initially with Jimmy Johnson and he did it with Bill Parcells. Outside of that, the other guys, I won't go so far as to say they're puppets, but in terms of spokesman, it's Jerry's show. Literally, he's got a radio show and a coach's show. A radio show and a television show. Who has that as an owner, as a general manager? No one. It's ego. And the reason why they're not very good and they're not very well coached, because A, there's no authoritative figure. There's a little bit of happenstance. Does the head coach control what the coordinator's doing? Of course not. The owners hire the assistant coaches. He speaks to the team through the media. What's the head coach going to do? The head coach is neutered in this case. And the head coach is also not very skilled in being able to execute and perform as well. You might say, well, I wouldn't have control if I had Jason Garrett as a head coach either. That's why you have Jason Garrett as the head coach. Because the owner, he's more influenced by the owner. Therein lies the problem. You don't see well-run organizations run that way. Now, behind the scenes, you can hold people accountable. You should hold them accountable. But you look at the places that have had success in the past. Cowboys have had success with Jimmy Johnson. They had success with Coach Landry. They've done it. But with Jerry, Jerry wants to win his way. And that's ego talking. You look at it. Ownerships who've had, and no one has been quite like that. Al Davis is the closest thing. And that was Jerry Jones's idol, Al Davis. And the difference is Al came up from a coaching and a scouting standpoint and had an idea of how to do it and had a pretty good staff at certain stages with the Ron Wolfs of the world to develop and draft really good roster in Oakland. But when he lost those guys and Al became the decision maker, you saw all the bad picks, the bad coaching hires. You know, Al would, you know, hey, Willie Brown, Fred Biletnikoff are coaches, whether you like it or not. Okay, you know, assistant coaches. I mean, and those good people and guys have done good jobs. But the reality is it was run that way. And you, quite frankly, once he began to run it that way, even he, as a good football guy, Al was a disaster. It was an absolute disaster. And he made mistake after mistake. You see the best organizations, they're the ones in which the owners support the group and let the football people make decisions and hold them accountable. And that's the biggest problem that the Cowboys have. I'm not saying that the Cowboys can't get on a roll and win it here this year and the next few years, but it's already been proven that it doesn't work. And doing it this way, if they win, it's almost by happenstance. Winning, you can win sometimes, and you might even be able to win a championship if things just kind of converge right. I've always believed that consistency in winning is the true greatness. If you're consistently good, if you consistently rebuild and retool and rehire and reshape and evolve and grow and adapt to different styles, that's what makes you really good. And if you put your egos aside, it's amazing what you can accomplish if no one is worried about who gets the credit. If I were to give a gift in this holiday season to Jerry Jones, it would be a plaque that says just that. It's amazing how much you can accomplish if no one is concerned about who gets the credit. I would glue it on his desk to where he'd have to look at it 12 hours a day. That's the biggest problem that the Cowboys have. Oh, no, Chris, it's Jason Garrett. It's probably the bad coach. Yes, because that's what Jerry's done. That's what Jerry's put forth. That's why Jerry's kept him forever. It's because that's what he wants. Now, he will likely, if this team loses the division, will likely, because Jason doesn't have a contract, next year will likely replace him. Now, does he replace him with a better football version, but somebody who can be walked on like a rug, like Jason is? Or does he give a little bit more control and say so to Stephen Jones' son and say, look, we need a better football guy. We need better organization. And if it comes with a commitment to hiring that new guy, that I'm not going to be as vocal in speaking all the time. If that's what's good, I'm gonna do that for the good of the organization. If he does that, I think it enhances their chances of winning. So, look, it's not, don't want to take shots at Jerry, but it's been a real issue. And you've had problems. And it's not just what you do in front of the camera, but it's behind the camera as well. It's a big part of it. Hey, before I get to a couple questions, or actually one question that I have, want to address what Lamar Jackson is doing right now. Kind of taking the league by storm. I do think he is MVP of the league at this point as we head into week 13. And people have asked me, is this going to change things? Well, don't know. It's change comes about in evolving. I think the change of, well, we're just going to flip the switch and change completely, that makes no sense, because there's no reason in football to make the radical change, because the radical change has not really proven to work. It's a gradual change. Now, it may appear to be radically different, but it usually comes over time. So we've seen an evolving of some concepts of the college game into the pro game. And people keep saying, oh, that's the future. We're going to play college football in the pro game. The pro game is still about a quarterback making plays from within the pocket, throwing the football. If you don't have that, you will not win. Let me repeat that. If you've got a quarterback that can't deliver the ball on time accurately from the pocket, you're not going to win. You may win some games. You're not going to win at a consistently high level. What is happening with Lamar Jackson is he is really developing as a pocket passer, throwing the football accurately. He certainly can throw it, and this is an added bonus, throw it on the move. And my God, can he run with the football? He's got it all. And if he can stay healthy, he can do things dynamically that you want. Now, it's not a different style, because if he couldn't throw the football accurately and he could still run great and he could make plays outside the pocket, it wouldn't be winning to the degree that they're winning. It would not be sustainable, because keep him in the pocket, he can't throw the football. Well, he can throw the football, and he can throw it accurate, and he can keep hit his receivers in stride. That's part of big part of accuracy. This is what's making it work. He's putting it together at this stage very, very well. Now, let's hold the horses on, it's going to revolutionize the game, and let's put him in the Hall of Fame right now. Let's hold off on that. SEC's more and more defenses in the playoffs, and let's do it for 2-3 years in a row, and he's continuing to get better and better and better. That's what you want to see. We're seeing some improvisational throws, what Mahomes is doing. We're seeing Lamar do that, and yet Lamar is a much better runner, much more explosive playmaker. So I absolutely love what he's doing, and I do think it's transformative. But here's the key, because everyone is going to see an athletic quarterback that can throw it pretty accurately in college, and they say, that's the next Lamar Jackson. No, it's not, because throwing it accurately in college is not the same thing as throwing accurately in the NFL. And a guy may be as athletic, he may complete, his completion percentage may be as good, but let me tell you what Lamar Jackson is that no one's talking about. Lamar Jackson is a very, very bright young man. He may not come across it in his talk, spent a lot of time. And when he came out, that's where my grade just jumped up with him, is when we met with them. Some of the meetings, teams that I do work for, where we got him on the board, and this guy's understand, you could tell he didn't have his offense memorized. He knew what other defenses are doing and why they were doing it. He is very bright, and he loves football. He works really hard. That's the key, folks. That's how he's gotten better. That's how he's developed as a passer, because you take a guy like a Greg Roman, and that staff, John Harbaugh's staff's done a great job with him. But you can have great teachers. If you don't have a great student, it's going to not work. It's working because that combination is a perfect marriage. This guy is really gifted, but it's not the physical gifts. It's the intangibles that no one really realizes that's making him great. That's what makes him different than the other great guys. Michael Vick, I heard the comparison all night in the game. Michael Vick didn't work hard. Michael Vick didn't study film. He did the minimum, and he flamed out. He didn't have a sustained career. This guy has all the signs that he wants to be great, committed to be great, and as long as that motivation is there, I think he will be great. Needs to stay healthy. We'll need to learn how to get down at times. But this guy's for real, and this team's for real. And, yes, I do think you can have more of these guys coming into the league. But when I say more of these guys, I'm saying the smart guy, the hardworking guy that has the athletic ability, has the ability to throw it accurately in addition to running it. You can have those guys, but can you put it all together? That's what makes you really good, or just makes you one of those guys that comes into the league, makes plays, have good games, but it's not sustainable. They flame out. We'll see what Lamar Jackson is going to be. I think he will be good. A little bit too early yet to be talking about all-time greatness. Really early. But he's off to a good start. Let's see it sustain into second, third year. My guess is he will, but let's let it play out. All right. End up today with a couple questions. Mitch asks, who invented the old run-and-shoot offense? That would be Miles Davis, who was at Portland State and worked in the World League and a couple of actually minor leagues before the USFL. But Miles Davis, the World League is where he actually before that, Portland State, he had Neil Lomax there, was the inventor, the basic inventor. Conceptually, there were some things going on similar, but the run and shoot was Miles. And then you ask, and why didn't that particular offense stick around like the spread offense stuff we see today? Well, it's completely different. Run and shoot offense is a completely different offense. Run and shoot offense has got the quarterback skilled. It was a complete drop back offense. It was, you had no tight end. You didn't, if you didn't protect the quarterback well, the quarterback got hit and hit and hit. It worked a lot of 5 and 7 step drops. So again, protection, it was all based upon protection and all based upon a quarterback that could make quick reads and side adjustments. And you have to have really good receivers that were not only talented, but were really good at reading coverages and be on the same page with the quarterback. It was not an easy offense to run, in essence. There was no physical element. So if you're constantly throwing it, you're putting your defense on the field, you're not running the football, you can't protect leads. That's why you can be up 35-3 at halftime against the Buffalo Bills and lose the game. Because you're throwing it, you're throwing it, you're throwing it, and all of a sudden, you got a drop here and a drop there and a stop there. And all of a sudden, your defense is worn out in the second half. You've heard me discuss that. Complimentary football, this was not. And it had no physical element to it. You can't run the football or the run and shoot. One back, try to gash a guy, no physical element. You get into the red zone, and it wasn't a very good red zone offense. The route concepts weren't really good. No tight end. Couldn't run it. So it lacked a run game effort, too much hit and miss, very tough to run and execute. So that's why it didn't last. People say, oh, well, the air raid's a completely different offense. The air raid's about getting the ball out quickly in the short passing game, whereas the run and shoot really worked. the downfield game a lot more, and you worked the double slots. You didn't have the tight ends. The RPO is totally different. The RPO is an option offense with a pass game element to it. So what's interesting about the RPO, it's such an easy offense to run. I mean, you're reading one guy. You got a built-in bubble screen. You got a built-in you hand the ball off or you throw it, as opposed to the option used to be the quarterback faked it or handed the ball off, reading the end, handing it off or running it himself. Now it's a handing it off or throwing it. And you can option the end. You can option the outside backer. You can option the safety. So the RPO stuff out of the spread is very easy to run, whereas the run and shoot, much more complex and had a lot more parts that had to come together for it to work. Jacob asks, let's see if I answered all of Mitch's questions. Yeah, there we go. Jacob asks, maybe it's an overreaction to a beatdown, but are the Rams, or Rams got blown out by the Ravens, are the Rams as screwed as they seem to be? They are paying Goff, which has regressed a ton, as well as Gurley, who doesn't seem to be long for the league. They just traded picks for Jalen Ramsey, and they have to pay him. No, I don't think it's an overreaction. I think they caught lightning in a bottle. I think they were a well coached. I think they had a good offensive line last year, and the defense played well, played situational defense. But they've definitely overpaid. They thought they were better than they were, thought they could make a run this year. It's why they traded away Jalen Ramsey and gave up all those picks. They have mortgaged their future. And Jalen Ramsey is not going to make them a contender this year or next year. And how do they fix that offensive line? And you're right. Goff is not a great talent. He's got some ability. He's functional. Certainly not a great quarterback. So they've got to do a better job of fixing the running game, and that starts with the offensive line. They've got limitations cap-wise and draft capital to fix it. Gurley is not long for the league from a durability standpoint. There's legitimate questions, significant questions, no question about it, for the Rams. And in a division where the Niners have a better roster and Seattle has as good a roster or better right now, and a better quarterback, I think that's a bad combination. In another division, it may not be as noticeable. In this division, it's going to be tough. And so I think the future is a big question mark with the Rams, Jacob. Look, again, it's a perfect example of an overreaction. Last year at this time, oh, my God, Sean McVay, anybody around him, genius. Who's going to stop this guy? He's the next Belichick. He's going to take over. Now we're talking about the future's bleak. Nothing. So that's why when I say, hey, Lamar Jackson, and it's great. It's going to revolutionize the game. Let's just, why can't we just let it play out? Going well. Let's see the sustainability. There's every reason to believe in the sustainability, but it's actually let them do it. You know, the only thing that's been sustainable in the NFL for a long time, the Patriots have been good for a while. I think the most consistent team in the NFC, and maybe one of the most consistent teams year in and year out the past few years, have been the Saints. They haven't gotten to the Super Bowl, but they were the best-looking team in the NFC the last 2 years. Better than the Rams. They didn't get there. I get that. But consistently good. They've been there and kind of won their division. You look at the up and down, topsy-turvy part of the league. You've had some teams that Baltimore's looking really good. They were trying to decide whether to stay with John Harbaugh last couple of years. A lot of up and down. Consistently good, we haven't seen it. And the Rams are the latest example of that. Were they a flash in a pan? Well, last year's team was. Can they remake themselves? Do they have the talent in the front office to do it? You know, I'm not a big Les Snead guy. A lot of people are. Les Snead is, you know, this Sean McVay is the football guy. And, you know, Les Snead's more of a figurehead guy and not a great evaluator. Their personnel decisions come operate a little bit different. And it's really what the coaches want. So Wade Phillips has really control over what they want defensively and who they sign and who they draft. And Sean has that control over the offense. That's how it works there. So Are they going to make the right decisions? Don't know. It's kind of like the Broncos. Oh, John Elway, great. He won a Super Bowl. They signed Peyton Manning. And the defensive coaches drafted Von Miller and Derek Wolfe and, you know, signed Tlaib and all those things. Okay, but the coaches change because you fire those guys and you make changes. So the guys that are the best evaluators are gone. So now you lose some of that. Well, the Rams have lost some of their guys. So are they going to be as good at finding those players? Well, because those coaches were so integral in evaluating and the decision-making process of who you draft and who you sign, sometimes that changes. And sometimes you're not as good. And you lose certain guys because people come after your players when you're successful. And can you, from a level of sustainability, replace those guys, replenish your roster? Can you do it as well? I mean, the reason why they're successful in New England is because the guy that makes the decisions is the head coach, and Matt Patricia can leave, and Brian Flores can leave, and, you know, anybody can leave in the front office. But the only guy that really matters is the head coach, because he can evaluate better than anybody, understand the value of a player, and move on from them sooner than later and get younger, cheaper guys and build a good team every year. He's the only one that's done it on a consistent level. Even New Orleans, who I mentioned, whose key personnel guy is Sean Payton. He's the guy that makes those decisions. They haven't been always as consistent. They were pretty successful when Sean was working with Ryan Pace on key personnel issues. And now Sean works with Jeff Ireland on it. But in the gap in between, it was very inconsistent. And that led to their dip a little bit, but they're back up. So you study every team. You have to know who does what in the organization, not who just who the media gives credit to. And I think the Rams are into some difficulty. It doesn't mean it can't be fixed, but they're going to have to figure out a way to draft well with limited talent. And they're going to have to, I do think they're in a little bit of trouble in terms of who they're going to pay. And Marcus Peters is a quick fix. It's going to cost them a lot of money. I think they have put themselves behind the eight ball in terms of how they fix this team. So I don't think you're overreacting to that. Hey, folks, have a happy Thanksgiving. Enjoy the games. Be safe if you're traveling. Remember, this is the only show that you're going to get from us this week. We'll be back next week to break it all down for you. React to, obviously, the latest college football standings, as well as where we're on the NFL. Keeping you up to date, breaking down the game of football, answering your questions, so make sure that you send it to us. For all the latest information, this weekend and all year round, every day, 7 days a week, go to LandryFootball.com. Take advantage of the football season savings special. You can get the remainder of the season, free agency, the draft, the evaluations of rosters, the college, the NFL recruiting, you name it. You have the coaching search, inside info. You'll want to be a part of LandryFootball.com so you can get all of that. Check it out today, LandryFootball.com. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. Enjoy the football.
To get more of Chris's knowledge, visit and subscribe to LandryFootball.com. You can also find him on Twitter at LandryFootball. This has been Landry Football on Radio Influence.
This is an In the Trenches with Ian Beckles quick fix on Radio Influence.
We look at the quarterback play throughout the league. Quarterbacks go off. Matt Ryan has been going off. You know what else has been happening with Matt Ryan? He hasn't been getting hit like he got hit yesterday. Matt Ryan got hit and hit and hit and hit. And even on plays where he wasn't hit, there was somebody in his face. You know what happens? You struggle. Aaron Rodgers had, I think, 33 pass attempts, and he had 104 yards passing. That's because the defense put it on him, and they beat the crap out of their O-line. It's not rocket science, everybody. Everybody think it's the quarterback that wins games. No, it's the line in that wins games. Thus, the name of my, you know, podcast, In the Trenches. You win games in the trenches, no doubt about that.
In the Trenches with Ian Beckles can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Podcasts, and RadioInfluence.com.